We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
I guess by way of beginning, would you just say a little bit about what your life looks like right now and what your kind of like the snapshot of what your business is? And then we'll kind of work backwards to how you got there.
So Secret Stash is a service-based agency. And at Secret Stash, we help other agencies, marketing, creative, advertising agencies build modern websites for their clients. And behind the scenes, that's really just a WordPress consultancy. It just so happens that we focus specifically on working with the agencies that, for whatever reason, have decided not to have full-time development staff.
So you come into agencies and provide the developmental support and kind of help them quarterback the different components that need to go into building a great website.
Yeah. So, you know, agencies are really good at design and UI and project management and account management. But, you know, it's only been about 10 years that this idea of digital has started to surface. And most of these agencies are older than that. And so it's really difficult for them to sort of change their culture and evolve into the digital space. And though many of them are trying to and some of them are successful, a lot of them have found that the biggest piece that they're missing is a solid development component. And even if they're pretty good at development in general, it can be kind of challenging to navigate all those different elements of development, right? So there's app development, there's website development, there's native development, and you can't really be great at all of those things, but agencies need to deliver that service to all of their clients. And so we just figured that maybe we could be that component that helps them build specifically WordPress projects. And so we niched ourselves down into that.
When did you build your first website?
I was playing around with Flash, which is not even
it's not a thing anymore. Yes, but I know what that is.
It's kind of cool. Yeah, it's nice to date myself a little bit. So probably like 2003, 2004, I was playing around Flash because you could draw the website. You didn't need to really have any development background. So I started doing that. I think I built my cousin a website for his landscaping business. I'm sure I built a few other things that were specifically in Flash. And then I started working for an IT company and I was building static HTML boilerplate websites for them. So, 2003, 2004, somewhere around there.
Well, I think it's interesting how people start. Like were you into computers before that? Like what drew you to the web?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, there is a specific reason why. So I was an English and philosophy major. And when I graduated college, I thought that I would be a copywriter. I don't know that Mad Men was a show at the time. It might've been, but I didn't know about it. But that's sort of the life I wanted. I wanted to be on Madison Avenue. I wanted to be this creative director. I wanted to wear the three-piece suits. I don't know why I wanted that, but I think it's because I lived in the North Jersey area and that sort of was the style. And so the assimilation seemed like it would be like in that direction if I were to head that way. But I couldn't get a job anywhere. In fact, the only opportunity on Madison Avenue I had was for an informational interview for an agency called Young and Rubicam. And that was going to be for like the mailroom. And I think the pay was going to cost me an additional $300 or $400 a month just to get into New York City. So it never actually happened. And eventually I found myself at a sports marketing company as this copywriter marketing assistant. And back then, the copywriter really was just a fancy name for the guy or the gal who update the website. And these days, you know, the websites didn't have CMSs. And so you were in like a tool like Dreamweaver and you're FTPing and a lot of times just writing on the server just to update content. And so that was sort of my introduction to the web. It was table-based. It was, you know, really primitive, but it was definitely something that was exciting because, you know, I had no idea what I was doing and someone was giving me the permission to do it. That was what led me to the IT job, which was sort of where I had this opportunity to do things that were a little bit more complex, but still without any background or experience or anything.
So your initial plan was to be, marketing, creative, wordsmithing, like the sort of Mad Men impression of making copy work for people. And you ended up in a more technical position than you expected to be. But it sounds like, has that felt like a fit? Is there part of you that is like, wow, I would love to go back to that writing philosophical mindset some days?
You know, I don't know that I actually wanted to be a copywriter because I thought I'd be good at it or that I had any passion to be one. It was just because I wanted to be in advertising. I was an English major, and how am I going to parlay that degree into something successful in advertising? And that was really the only thing. So it's interesting that I now am working with the agencies that I maybe would have been working for. And the experience today is I kind of snuck in the back door, and I'm sitting at the board table or the conference room table, having conversations with founders and agency owners and these people who otherwise I don't think I ever would have had the opportunity to, right? So had I gone the traditional path, I don't know that I'd be a creative director now. But the way that I sort of like built my career, and this is totally on accident, or if anything, it was subconscious, I'm where I wanted to be. And it's not that I wanted to be, I think, a copywriter. I wanted to be in the strategy meetings. I wanted to be thinking of what we could collectively do to build something amazing. And it just so happens that the technical side was where I sort of fit. And now I'm there, but like from a totally different trajectory.
A totally different route than you expected.
Yeah.
Were there early inclinations that you would eventually become an entrepreneur, that you would own your own business? You know, were you entrepreneurially minded as a child?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So in I think it was like second or third grade, I don't know like how I came about the idea, but I went to like the craft store and bought beads and whatever is necessary to build or to make these necklaces. And I started doing like the Jets and the Giants and the Yankees colors. And I would, you know, spell out in the beads. I would buy the beads that had the letters on them and spell out Yankees and Jets and all that stuff. And I started bartering with my classmates because no one had money. And what I was bartering for were lunch tickets, which was funny because I had to make my lunch, which I thought was unfair. I had to make my lunch. And so I basically put two pieces of bread. And my lunch was actually like checked before I left. So I had to actually do it. I couldn't just say I did it. So I would put two pieces of bread together, put it in foil, like grab a muffin or something. I didn't actually do any of the work because I didn't really want to. And so I didn't really have a lunch. And so I was bartering for these lunch tickets. And it turns out that a certain percentage of the people who get lunch tickets get it because it might be the only hot meal that they get in a day. And I was actually like stealing their lunch for these bead necklaces. I didn't know that at the time, but very quickly I got in a little bit of trouble because one day I wanted two hot lunches, and that was an unusual thing for anyone to do. I think it raised a red flag. And then I had to have a conversation with my teacher. I didn't get into any real trouble, but it certainly put the kibosh in that. So that was my first.
Your first like, hustle. Stint.
Yeah. In eighth grade, I was really big into snowboarding, and I was in Austria. So early years of my life, my dad's in the military. And so I grew up in Germany, and we would spend some time in Austria skiing. And I saw this kid with this incredible, like Dr. Seuss, which is today, like that's ridiculous. But then I thought he was the coolest kid in the world, like a Dr. Seuss looking snowboard hat. And so when I came back to the States, I bought a sewing machine and then started sewing those types of hats. And then those were the first thing that I actually sold. I sold it to a local skate shop. I think I sold like 25 you know, fleece snowboard hats. They were horrible, but you know, this guy just took an interest and said, yeah, I'll buy a couple from you. So that was actually real. And that was the first time that I actually put up like a strategy and like had the conveyor belt system of steps that need to happen in order to be efficient with it. And so that was sort of when I think my dad recognized that, you know, this is sort of the direction I was headed and started to be, you know, much more motivational with that type of stuff. And then in high school, I had a clothing company called East Coast Section. It was sort of like a skateboarding, rollerblading, BMX clothing company. The place that I printed my t-shirts was the same place that Mark Echo printed his t-shirts. And it was around the same time that he started. So like, this is like 96, 97. We both printed at the same print shop. Of course, Mark Echo became an international phenomenon in fashion. And I didn't, but nonetheless, it was super fun.
Yeah. So there's been this like consistent interest in crafting things, but also in kind of fashion and promoting this particular kind of snowboard skate kind of lifestyle.
Yeah. Whatever I was into at the time, I wanted to figure out how I could be part of it from like the professional community. Like ever since a little kid, like that's the way I thought about things. Like my hobbies were never like team sport type stuff. They were more individual type sport. And there was always a subculture of the business community that was super interesting because it wasn't very corporate. Eventually, you know, skateboarding becomes corporate and snowboarding has become corporate, but there's always been this sort of subculture where the participants are also the owners of these companies once they become big enough and well-known enough. And I just thought that to be really interesting. I wanted to be part of it.
Do you have any of your Dr. Seuss hats left?
I don't. A couple, about 10 years ago, my dad actually gave me one of my like printed sweatshirts as like a Christmas gift because he knew I wouldn't have kept any. And I don't have any like memories stored away like a lot of people do. And so none of these things actually like really exist anymore. So people have to just take my word for it that they even happened.
But your dad has, or at least had a sweatshirt for you that he gave back to you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was, and I kept that for a really long time. Of course, I don't know where it is now, but I did keep it for a while.
How did your experience being in a military family, do you think, shape your path to being an entrepreneur?
I don't know that it had much of an impact at all, really. My dad was a colonel, and I say that people have this sort of like idea of what life must have been like growing up, but it's probably the opposite. I never felt like I had any like specific obligation to stand tall or to do any of these things that you'd expect a military kid to do. As a matter of fact, I think my dad did everything he could to make sure I didn't go down that path. And he was super supportive of me doing things on my own. He was a little bit entrepreneurial. When we came back to the States, he in the garage, he was framing like picture framing. And so he had a little bit of a side hustle too. I don't know that he actually really interested in never making money from his side hustles, but he's always like been a cabinetry carpenter and stuff like that. And he would build stuff for friends. So
like a maker.
Yeah, he's a maker for sure. And, you know, he was sort of in that transitional period where makers actually were makers. And then now makers are sort of software developers. And so he had an interest in computers early on. And so when he retired from the military, he went on to be, you know, part of like Northrop Grumman and those bigger aeronautical engineering firms as a sort of liaison between the private world and the military world. And I think I at an early age got access to some stuff. I had a computer probably before most people, and so was exposed to it. And he was writing a little bit of code. And so it wasn't something that like he impressed upon me in any way of saying like, this is the future, but it was there. So, you know, I had access to it, which I think helped.
Yeah. You do have somebody who is a leader in his field and who is, you know, at this interface between these two pretty important entities in American life. And it sounds like that afforded you some access to things that were at least interesting to you.
Yeah. And I think the reason why I ended up taking philosophy in college was because my dad spent a lot of time, he was in Vietnam. And so I think that shaped a lot of his thinking. And so he started to study more on sort of like the conflict between freedom and authority.
So let's jump forward a little bit back to this point where you left your copywriting job and now you are working in IT. How did you make the transition from working for other people to finally owning your own business?
Yeah, so that was a big jump. So I'm at this IT company and on the surface, it looks like a decent job. I have a salary, I have benefits. It was the first time I had either of those things. It's 2004, 2005. So the economy is still doing pretty strong. So everyone's, you know, expecting this to last forever. And I'm just bored, miserable. The company on the inside was really, I mean, today's we would call it a startup, right? Because if you didn't make any money and you spent a lot, then you're probably a startup. But it wasn't a startup. It was a bootstrapped company. The guy who ran it, this dude, Musa Murashi, who was a very early executive for IBM. He branches out on his own and he starts building these like skeleton products, which it's funny. It's today. He was about 15 years too early. He was building out these products that everyone looked at him and be like, oh, that's not possible. You can't do that on the web. You can't do that on the web. And here we are, all of those things that he had suggested are now not only possible, but people have made a lot of money doing them. So I think a little bit of like his entrepreneurial spirit started to brush off on me. And in that workstation above me, there was a calendar for that year of Vail Resorts. And I just kept looking at it and looking at it and looking at it. And I'm in New Jersey at the time. And I'm thinking back to when I got to ski and snowboard in Austria. And so I'm thinking, what am I even doing here? I don't enjoy what I'm doing. Like this career isn't going where I thought it would go. I'm not a copywriter. I'm not on Madison Avenue. None of these things are happening. Like what if I just gave it all up and moved out west to snowboard? And I started toying around with that idea and I started like feeling out what my family thought about it. So I would ask, you know, my aunts and my uncles and my cousins, and everyone thought it was a bad idea. Everyone's like, no, that's stupid. Like you shouldn't do that. You know, you have a career, things are going in the right direction. And I basically was about to give it up. And then I was like, I'll just call my dad and see what he thinks. And so I give him a call. I say to him, like, I think I'm going to give everything up. And I moved to Colorado to be a ski bum. And I almost said it like tongue in cheek, expecting him to be like, well, that's stupid. But instead, and this is sort of like the way it's always been with my dad, is I say, I think I'm going to go out there. I think I'm going to be a ski bum. He's like, well, you'd be closer to me. Yeah, I like this idea. What if I fly out and then we drive out together? And so, of course, when you have that type of permission to do something really stupid, it makes it easy to just give everything up because, you know, you have this safety net. And it's not necessarily like a financial safety net, although my dad would always help me out wherever he could. It was more like this idea that, well, if I fail, you know, there's no judgment. So why not?
No one's going to be wagging their pointer finger at you saying, I told you so. I told you not to do this. This was a risky, bad idea. But he's like, hey, I understand why you'd want to do that. Go kind of go for it. See what happens.
Yeah. And so he did. He flew out and then we drove out. And I had never been to Colorado before. We drove from Jersey to Colorado pretty much without stopping, however many days that took. And the goal was really just to stay there for, you know, that winter. But on that drive, like something happened. Only a couple of times in my life have I felt like I've had a panic attack. And this was one of those times. I think it was probably the first time. It was something like a panic attack where I'm halfway through. So you've almost reached that point of no return. I've committed to this job at Vail Resorts to be a lift operator. I'm basically deciding to spend all of my savings just to make it work. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell did I just do? And so in the fashion that I've always sort of like pulled myself out of those types of like mental states, I was like, all right, well, what's the solution? How do I look at this as a learning experience? How do I actually build something or gain some knowledge from this experience? And so I said, well, you know, it's the early days. Well, I'm not saying this, but you know, it is the early days of the web and there aren't snowboard magazines on the web. And so what if I were to just like, I think I had a camera, like a nice film SLR camera. What if I just start taking pictures of the local pros or like just the local talent? And what if I built this website that was specifically around Colorado snowboarding? And maybe I can learn how to build websites the right way. And maybe I can learn how to build a community somehow. And this is really, really early days of all of that stuff. And so I think, well, if no one else is doing it, like how hard could it be for me to actually gain traction when there's no competition? And so my dad's sleeping on the passenger side and I'm going through this in my head and it calms me down and I say, okay, well, I'm going to make a promise that if I stick around for more than 6 months, then I'm going to do this thing. And it helped me basically get through that mindset where I was like throwing all this opportunity waited to basically make $8 an hour to spin a lift. And that actually happened. So I don't know that it happened in the first winter, but I think it's the second winter I launched a website that was called Project Winter. And then that eventually became a project known as Ride the Beave. And Ride the Beave just refers to Beaver Creek, which is the mountain that I ended up becoming like a local at. And it was probably even to this day, the biggest thing that I've ever done. And it was completely on accident. Like people still like a guy got the logo tattooed on his arm. It was just ridiculous because the logo is a beaver skull.
Like it's super significant to the people who live and work and like vacation in that community or who ski there.
Yeah, because everyone's so proud of it, right? And no one really understands it. Everyone sort of like looks down at them as a result of it. So this thing was like that thing that allowed this subculture within that community to sort of like thrive and show off to their friends back home. And so it was basically this blog. So my career basically in WordPress development is because I built this community website that got real big.
And so like what's happening in your life at this time? Like you're snowboarding a lot, you're doing stuff on the web. Like, are you feeling like, man, I have arrived? Or is there a darker side to the story? Is there some failure or anxiety that you're contending with at this time?
Yeah. So I was always a big drinker. And for the last year or so, I've been thinking a lot more about sort of how alcohol got into my life and how it sort of like became part of my identity for a long time. And this is where it started to become a real problem. If you think about it, for most people, right, they start drinking in high school and it's an odd time to be introduced to that. And I started to think around how like there's probably a point in every human's life where their unique personality starts to emerge, right? Like prior to high school, your network is like that 3-block radius that you're allowed to ride your bike around. And then all of a sudden you jump into this like weird part of life where at 15, you look like a 10-year-old, but at 17, you look like a 25-year-old. And like, you're also introduced to all these things that are sort of hard to like absorb at that state in life. And so I believe that as you're emerging as your unique self, if you're introduced to alcohol, alcohol can actually shape like how you are. So I think that, you know, I was always meant to be an introvert. When I went through high school, my mother passed away of cancer at like 15 when I was a sophomore in high school. And so at the same time that that's happening, I'm introduced to alcohol. It's what's weird about that whole situation is that when my mom passes away, you know, like the expectation is that I'm going to revolt, that I'm going to like do worse in school. And actually the opposite happened. I actually started doing better in school and I started to really retreat into my head. And I saw myself being less interested in team sports like soccer and more interested in stuff like skateboarding and rollerblading and snowboarding and things like that, things I could do by myself. And so I think I was headed into that introverted world. I think that's what I was sort of always meant to sort of be. But then also I'm introduced to alcohol, and alcohol was my crutch for me to actually participate in whatever social construct you had in high school. And there was no big deal, right? Everyone was doing it. There's no responsibility. And then you leapfrog that into college and it's not that much different. There's really not a whole lot of responsibility. There's no one there certainly to hold you to that responsibility. And then when you graduate, you sort of are meant to grow up, and most people do. And I found myself never really being able to separate that life. And so, you know, now it's a couple of years later and I'm in Colorado and I'm working for myself. I'm not full time at this point. I'm working for a restaurant and I'm building websites and I'm snowboarding. So there's not a whole lot of stress in my life. But then at some point I decide that it's ready for me to do this on my own, to give this a real shot. And I don't remember exactly when that was, but when I did that, I hadn't yet matured to understand how you navigate anxiety and stress. So to me, it was either redlining or none at all. Like I never understood how to like navigate between the different levels of stress that I could convince my body that this isn't actually that big of a deal. And so I was drinking all the time. It was basically the way that I navigated or mitigated any stress.
It's how you regulated your emotional life.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, I drank to go out. I went out to drink. And then you start working for yourself and I stopped going out. Like it was almost like, okay, I don't have time for any of this, but I still need alcohol in order to sort of like help me go to sleep because I wasn't able to otherwise. It was always like up all night worrying about things that didn't even matter.
How long did that go on where you were really using alcohol to regulate emotions and sleep?
So it was happening regularly before I was full time by myself. But when I started working full time, I was drinking every single day and I was probably drinking like 8 to 10 beers a night, like a lot. I'm not a big guy. Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of alcohol. And you know, it's like you look back in life and like, wow, like your picture perfect for like an ad because like my roommates at the time would notice it and they would say something. And so to avoid that, I would just hide it, you know, and it became one of those things where it's like, I don't really care what people think, but at the same time, I don't really want people having an opinion. So I'm just going to avoid, you know, that confrontation.
And how did you come to a point where you decided that wasn't a good idea?
Like everyone in their head has this idea of what a good person is. And you kind of like will do stuff that you're not really proud of, but you say to yourself, well, if I don't do these things over here, these things that I've defined as being what makes you a bad person, then I'm still a good person. And I can go on with my life thinking that everything's fine, even though I know there's a problem over here. But with addiction, I think that almost everyone starts to like cross off some of those things on that list on the right, that list that you would promise yourself you'd never do. And I started to see myself crossing those things off. So, you know, I never killed anybody. You know, I never did anything like that was bad. I never got a DUI, but I drove drunk. I took advantage of people who didn't deserve it. And there was a window of probably like 3 to 6 weeks where I had done a bunch of things that I would wake up the next morning being really embarrassed about. And at some point, I don't remember what it was, but at some point I remember just saying to myself, well, you know, I think you have a decision to make. Either you own this lifestyle and then never look back, or you make a decision to remove it entirely because
you had the sense that you needed to just like fully give into it and redefine the sense of who you are by sort of giving yourself over to this lifestyle, or you needed to totally walk away from it and stop drinking entirely.
Yeah. at some point within the last 6 to 8 years, I gave up drinking. And when I did it, it was, you know, a promise that I made. And I've only made a few promises to myself, and I've never broken them. I've broken plenty of promises to other people, but never to myself. And so I knew that if I said, hey, I'm done, that this isn't just something I'm saying, like this is going to have to happen. And I did it. I mean, I gave up drinking, and I was able to actually get through it without a community, but it was definitely something that wasn't easy because it was such a big part of my social personality. It was really, really hard, like getting myself back into that community of friends because it was so intertwined into my personality.
You kind of had to figure out who you are. I mean, you had to, without any of that social lubricant of alcohol or...
Yeah, it's funny. So there's a significant point in my life that if you met me before this point, you have an opinion of me. And if you met me after this point, you have an opinion of me, but they're not the same, right? So like I tested a year ago on my personality type, and I tested as an INFJ, and I tested twice. And the reason why I went for it twice is because INFJ is like the rarest of all, which I was like, that can't be true. But then as I started to read up on what that means, like that actually is me. And so I posted it on Facebook, and I had a lot of comments from my past. They're like, but you're not introverted. And it's funny. It's like everyone who knew me prior to giving up drinking, like remembers me as this social person, but they probably don't remember me sober either. You know, like people who knew me from high school and college, like they remember that. And they're like, but you didn't have a problem, right? And it's like, and then people who met me after are like, you don't like people, do you? You know, like, which is, I joke about stuff like that. Like, oh, like, but there's people there, you know? So I have this like split in my life where prior to that, there's this one person. And then after it, there's this other person. And now I'm starting to figure out who this other person is because I've only been around for a few years.
Yeah. How has your decision to eliminate alcohol from your life? How do you think that's shaped your business?
Well, I'm glad it was something that I did 8 years ago or however long it was ago. And I don't have to deal with it today because like it's hard for me. And I don't journal. I know I should, but I don't remember like the exact stretch of time that I struggled. But after giving up alcohol, I wasn't just replacing that immediately with health and fitness, which I have since done. Instead, I was replacing it with work entirely. And so I got to the point where I was shaking. And I was getting these migraines, and I was just so unhealthy. And I remember one time I was on, I don't know if I called my dad or my dad called me, but I'm talking about how my server's down, which, you know, for me is a big deal, but you know,
yeah, that's a bummer,
but it's, you know, I have 3 or 4 clients on the server. It's like 10 at night and no one's called me and I'm freaking out. And my dad can hear it in my voice. And he says something that I'll never forget. He says, there are kids right now that are 10 years younger than you who are in a foxhole getting shot at, and they don't have the level of stress that you have. He's like, are you sure you really have the right to be as stressed as you are right now? And I was like, oh man, geez, you're right. You know, like,
way to bring it down, dad.
Yeah. And I know he wasn't trying to say it in like a condescending way.
Yeah, but he gave you some context.
And so I'll never forget that, because what was happening was that I didn't have any idea of how to like bucket how bad things were. They were either perfect or they were horrible, and there's no in between. And so I really had to start to create this muscle memory. I was so young in entrepreneurship. I hadn't experienced anything like it before. And then 10 years later, I've experienced everything like it. And so I can use experience to remind myself how bad something is based on how bad it was in the past. And that's just something that experience really requires. But again, like, you know, if you don't have a support network, like, where do you go? You don't go anywhere. And I've given up alcohol, which was the one way that I took care of it. And so now I'm sitting here working all the time. And that was the way that I took care of it. I was just like, I'll just keep working. Oh, I'll just keep working. And then I got to a point where I was very underweight. My sleep patterns were awful. I was eating horribly, and my body just gave up. And what it did was basically just start throwing out these, I mean, just incredible migraines.
It sounds like at this point you're trying to practice moderation, which has never been your strong suit. But this sense of like not working too much, not being so hardcore about diet and exercise, allowing some fun in your life as well as some productivity.
Yeah. And at this point, I'm still in the ski community. So I haven't yet left at this point in time. And so, you know, it was easy for me to sort of just coast along as this freelancer, because you didn't need to make a lot of money in order to make that life work. And there was a lot of activity around you, but there was nothing there that really like kept me motivated to do any of this stuff. So I feel like even though I was getting better at the moderation, like it was really just me just jumping around from thing to thing based on this community that didn't really expect much of me. And so eventually I moved down to Denver, and this is sort of the last 3 years of when Secret Stash has really become a real business. This is where that work that I put in 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago is actually starting to come to fruition, because these days I don't really feel like much can bother me.
Which is a really amazing turnaround. And I know it feels like a long time to you, but in the course of your life, to go from feeling like you had pretty limited ability to handle stress and anxiety and even regulate your emotions and sleep without, you know, the external support of alcohol, to get to a place where you feel like you can build something that you're proud of and that's important to you, that comes from inside of you without being out or dysregulated, I guess is the best way to say it, without being dysregulated.
Yeah, I think that giving up alcohol was the foundation for everything. The biggest challenge of giving up alcohol is the way that people look at you. It's so funny to me that it's weird that people don't drink, but not weird if someone's a binge drinker.
It's really the opposite of what it should be, right? We should raise our eyebrows a little more. And
it's because it's so accepted, and that's what grownups do. And you know, as long as you don't have a problem, there is no problem. And that's actually not true. Like the foundation of a good, solid, healthy lifestyle is sleep. It's the foundation. And you just cannot get good sleep if you have alcohol in your system, like at all, within a couple hours of going to sleep. And so when people talk about, oh, I wish I could get good sleep. So, oh, you can, you certainly can, but you can't drink and get good sleep. And so no one's going to get to the optimal performance that they have within them if they're drinking. But of course, you can't just tell somebody to stop drinking, because it's not your right to do that. But for me, I didn't give up alcohol so that I could figure out how to get great sleep and then from that figure out all these other things that sort of come after. It just sort of happened that way. But from good sleep, from a like regimented diet with exercise and fitness, with understanding like how your body works with regard to when you want to work, all of those things are stepping stones, right? And it's like I could never have learned any of those other things had I not given up alcohol, but I didn't give up alcohol for any of those things. It's just sort of like the added benefit of doing it. And now my life is scheduled and regimented as it is. It feels more loose, right? Because I'm aware and around and I'm active and I'm like excited for those extra few minutes to do other things if I can fit them in a day, because I have the energy to do it, which is just not possible when your diet is crummy and you're drinking all the time and you're smoking cigarettes or whatever, a number of things.
You can be present and show up to your life and show up to your business in a way that you haven't been able to fully be before.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course now it's like the amount of stress that I mitigate today compared to when I couldn't handle it is not even comparable.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.